Welcome to the Spirit Aligned Leadership Program, Legacy Leader Podcast.
Today, we are featuring Circle 2 Legacy Leader, Sharon Day, Ojibwe, from Bois Fort Reservation in Minnesota, in a December 2020 interview with Program Director, Gail Small.
Pivawana, good morning. This is Gail Small. I am from the Northern Cheyenne Indian Reservation, and I'm the Program Director of Spirit Aligned Leadership Program. Today, I'm very honored to be with Sharon Day as we begin an interview to share on our program website. So Pivawana, Sharon, I'd like you to introduce yourself to the audience, please.
Bonjour, Nanindwe, Nagamo Mayengan and Dishnakaz, Wabashashi and Dodem, Ojibwe, Ikwe, Ndao, Madewanakwe, Ndao. In English, I said, greetings, my relatives. My name is Singing Wolf, although most people know me by my English name, which is Sharon Day. And I'm from the Bois Fort Reservation in northern Minnesota. I'm an Ojibwe woman and second-degree Madewan, and also one of the water women that was lifted up to take that responsibility some years back.
Thank you, Sharon. There's a lot in that introduction that I'd like to share a little bit with the audience, because I'm not sure a lot of them know. What is the Madewan? Could you talk a little bit about that? And I'd also like just to lift up your name. That's a powerful name, your tribal name. Can you tell us a little bit about maybe what that name represents, or how you got that name?
So when we were born, there are 13 of us children, siblings, that survived infancy. And we were all gifted with a spiritual name at birth. When I got to be a teenager, I asked my mom, well, what is my spirit name? And she said, you know, I don't remember. And so as I continued on with my life, I thought, you know, like I need to find that name. And so I was visiting the Seneca Nation. I was probably about 30, 36. And in my mind, I had everything set up how I would go about retrieving that spirit name. And one of the elders at the Seneca Nation was at her house and spent the night. And we did a ceremony that night. Anyhow, the next morning, she got up really early and she came and said to me, do you have a spirit name? And I said, you know, I did have one, and nobody remembers what it is. And she said, I would like to gift you with a name, if that's okay with you. And so I had brought peaches to her on my way there, because, you know, you never go visit an auntie or an elder without bringing something. And I had these peaches. And so her helper made pancakes, and he made used those peaches to make a topping, you know, a syrup for the pancakes. So that was our feast. And then she stood me up, and in Seneca, my name is Otawani Adanat, which is Singing Wolf. And then when I came home, I had it translated into Ojibwe. And so it did not happen any of the way I thought it would happen. But I felt so blessed to be given that name by the clan mother of the Wolf clan of the Seneca Nation.
Wonderful. You know, I just want to stop you for a moment there, because you lift up an important point for a lot of, particularly, I think, younger tribal members that maybe, you know, weren't able to get like that tribal name growing up. But the point I want you to lift up, like what you just said, is retrieval. Is that it's never too late, right, to learn and to retrieve our culture. Even though you were never born into it, it's never too late.
Yes, there was a Dakota woman elder who lived here, and we were at the university, and she was speaking to students, and some of the students, of course, had been adopted out and didn't know who they were, and they said, well, we don't even know where to start. And it was that sort of attitude of like being so lost and not knowing where to start. And what she said to them was, you know, go sit by a tree, go sit by the river, sit and be still. And some of that will come to you, because even if you don't remember, or people around you don't remember, the earth remembers.
That's wonderful. That's so powerful. Thank you for sharing that. Now, could you tell us a little bit about what you referenced, the Madewan?
Yes. The Madewan translates into English as the Grand Medicine Society. But we, Anishinaabe, we refer to it more as the Path of the Heart Way. And when I was little, I would ask my dad, who are the Madewan? And he would say, well, they're the people who learn about the medicines to help the people. Well, how do you get to be Madewan? And he said, you need to be invited. Well, who gets to be invited? People with a good heart. And so I went to ceremonies. The first Madewan ceremony I went to was about 1975, before the Indian Freedom of Religion Act was passed. And we went way out into the bush, and there were about 30 of us. We all fit into a teepee. And that was the first ceremony. And as years went by, and I would go back, back and forth, back and forth. And I'm a recovering alcoholic. And when I got into recovery, I was 21 years old the first time. And then my father was murdered when I was 23. And I began to drink again then, and I drank for about 6 months. And then my mother said, you must go to treatment. And so I did. And so I've been sober since I was 23 years old, continuously. And in recovery, you know, they talk about through prayer and meditation. Well, I knew what prayer was, but I wasn't quite sure what meditation was. So there was a woman I met who did transcendental meditation. And I learned meditation from her. She was a very gentle woman. And then I began to go to ceremonies more frequently. And so I went to ceremonies for 17 years, cooking and cleaning pots and, you know, doing all that kind of work until 1998. We were starting a school, an art and culture school for Native kids. And I thought, you know, if I'm asking these kids to learn culture, I better make sure that I know what I'm talking about. So I offered my asema, and so you stand at the doorway of the lodge and you ask the grandmothers, and this went down, we Madewan, I wish to be a Madewan. And they say, okay. And then you study for a year. It's not like Madewan isn't like being a Lutheran where you go to church for a while and then you're Lutheran, right? You have to study, and they teach you songs and the creation story. And if you don't have a name, you seek that name, you find your clan. You have to know those things to become a Madewan. And so at the end of that first year, I was at that doorway again, had made my bundle. I was standing in the doorway. And I was so afraid because I thought, you know, I remembered my dad saying, people who have a good heart. Well, what's a good heart? People with good moral character. And I thought, what if the grandmothers don't think I have a good moral character? Even though I'd been in recovery for so long, you know, I was a two-spirit woman. I was a lesbian, queer. And like, what are they going to think about that? And I'm kind of notorious in that, you know. But then when I got to the doorway and after that year of studying, and I said, and this way, Don, we Madewan, I was so terrified, and they said, come in. And I ran in that lodge. And that was in 1998. And then I went through again in 2008. And every time, you know, they say there are seven teachings. In each teaching, when you're the first degree, you're given so much of the teaching. And then if you go again, after they give the first teaching, they excuse everybody. They excuse the initiates, the first degree. But then if you're going to be a second degree, then you stay a little bit longer because then you're given more. So within each teachings, there are seven more, right? So.
How beautiful, huh? That we still have these ways to lift up. And by all means, you know, you're welcome into that circle. Thank you for sharing that with us, Sharon. Okay, so tell us a little bit about growing up on the res and then your shift into the Minneapolis, St. Paul area with your family.
Yeah. So as I said earlier, you know, I'm one of 13 children. My parents actually had 17 children, and four of them did not survive infancy. I was born at a place called Sugar Bush. It was a point on Pelican Lake, and it was called Sugar Bush because of all the maple trees. And of course, our family tapped those trees, and my mom and dad. My dad was a guide and a hunter, and you know, he would take people out on the lake or hunting or trapping, and that's how he made a living. And I think he was only really happy when he was in the woods. My mother was a cook and spent most of her time taking care of us. We moved off of the reservation when I was in a foster home for a couple of years. I'm not quite sure how old I was, but might have been three until I was six, or four until I was six. But when I went back home, my parents had moved off the reservation. It was only about 30 miles, but you know, in those days, you didn't have a car. It could have been 100 miles. My parents were, my mother was like the rock, you know, like this really solid person. And my dad was this charismatic. You know, my dad was the smartest man I ever met. He could make anything. He could, you know, he was a self-taught musician, played in a swing band for a while. It was just, you know, pick up an instrument and learn how to play it. And so I think I got my love of music from him. And, but for my mother, I got stability. My dad was also a practicing alcoholic, and my mother was a saint. She did not drink. She did not smoke. And the worst possible thing she could say to you is, "You are foolish." You know, that was just like broke your heart when she said that to you, you know. And but anyhow, so most of my life has been lived off the reservation, even though, you know, like I say, it was 30 miles. My dad felt like, even though he couldn't live out here in this world, that we needed to. And in order to do that, we had to have a good education. And he felt as though going to public school would serve us well. And he was fairly right about that. You know, we learned how to get along with other folks, and we were still proud. You know, he always taught us, be proud of who you are. You know, our people, we had two orientations to life. You know, at home we did things this way. And then when you went to school or you went anyplace else, you kind of just sat there and observed how people were, what people were doing. And then you acted like them, you know. But at home, we knew, you know, exactly who we were. And my dad would, you know, sit us outside a tree and he'd tell us stories, and he would draw in the sand, you know, the migration story. And so when I did go into the Medewin, like, I knew some of that because I grew up watching my dad. You know, he would give a teaching, and then he never had a drum. I don't know why, but he would, you know, take a Arco coffee can, turn it upside down, and then he would sing, you know, and then we'd all dance. And that's exactly what happens in ceremonies. You know, you're given a teaching on a sand scroll, and then you're given a song, and then everyone dances. And so even though we didn't live on the reservation, you know, we learned, we always knew who we were and what our role was in life. And because I'm from the Martin clan, the Wabashashi clan, it's our job to protect the people. So from the time I was little, I can hear my dad saying, your job is to take care of the family, the clan, the band, the tribe, and ultimately all of humanity. That was like drilled into us. And so everybody in my family, we're sort of all do-gooders, you know, like teachers, social workers, servant government, you know, we're all like that. And I always think, you know, like, how come one of us didn't never become, you know, like a millionaire? Well, that wasn't our value. Our value was to share. If you plant a garden, the first row is for the children. The second row is for the elders. And then you plant for your family. So, you know, that's a totally opposite. That's a value, you know, that's so different than people in the United States. Mm-hmm. Everything for you first. This way everybody was taken care of.
Very true. Very, very important value that I think Indian people, like a lot of our tribes, you know, we don't fit into that, the Western, I guess, system. United States, I guess, how difficult that is, you know. Can you tell us a little bit, Sharon, about how moving to an urban area, how what you experienced and how you made it through that transition? Because, you know, a lot of our younger people, they're in constant transition. And how do you develop the ability to adapt?
Yeah, it was very difficult. When I was 15, I have an older brother. He was living in the state of Washington with one of my older sisters, and he came home, and, you know, my dad had begun drinking more at that time. And my brother Stan came home, and he told my dad, he said, I'm going to take Sharon with me. And if you don't let her go, I will take the whole family. So my dad said, okay, take her. So the first place I lived out in northern Minnesota was out in the state of Washington, and it was a small rural community, Snohomish. And I stayed there for a year, and then when I was there, my mom had, I think I was kind of the buffer between my mom and my dad. And so when I left, she moved to St. Paul like about 2 months later. And so then I picked strawberries all summer, strawberries, raspberries, and I made enough money to come home on the milk train. And so in September the following year, I was a sophomore in high school, and, you know, I got off the train. Nobody had phones then. Got the train, and I had an old map where I traced the route to my mom's address. And I got there and totally surprised her. And but St. Paul was much different than up north or Snohomish. It was, you know, it was so different. It was really culture shock. My younger brother and I, we would, you know, we'd hitchhike up north every chance we got, every weekend during the summer. You know, we just hitchhike, you know, just to be up north was, but then, you know, gradually over years, you adjust. And I think the high school that I went to was, the teachers were excellent, and, you know, I was in the band, and I worked for my band teacher, and my high school was a block from the state capitol. So after I'd lead the band practice, I would come out the back door of the school, and then I would listen. And if I heard noise, this is 1966, 1967, 68, it was 67, 68, 69, if I heard noise coming from the Capitol, I would go over there. And this was during the time of the Vietnam War protests, right? Mm-hmm. And our high school went on strike with the University of Minnesota students. And but I heard people there, you know, the civil rights leaders of the day, Angela Davis. When I was in Washington, I met Bobby Kennedy. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget that either, you know. You know, I was at that rally and he was speaking, and I tell everybody, you know, like, he looked at me, mm-hmm. you know, he looked at me in the eye and smiled, and everyone said, sure, sure. But you know what? Later on, I come to find out that Jack and President Kennedy had begun in the 60s, the investigation or the study of Indian education. Mm-hmm. And then when he became president, he turned it over to Bobby, and Bobby continued that study. And so 1966, I was at Evergreen College in at a rally that Bobby Kennedy was at. And of course, my hair was, you know, down to my butt, straight, long black hair then. So, and I was pretty noticeable. But I believe he did look at me. And those eyes, what incredible eyes. And, but anyhow, but I heard so many civil rights leaders, and I felt, you know, I was just this little shy Indian kid, never said hardly anything to anybody, but I believed it was important for me to be there. Mm-hmm. It was important for me to be there. And, you know, that is something that I've instilled in all of my children, my biological children, my grandchildren, my grandchildren of the heart. Be there. And so, you know, we've taken our kids to, you know, Washington, D.C. during Standing Rock when, you know, there was the, we took them to Standing Rock, we took them to Washington, D.C., to the peace and climate marches. I think it was a native march. We took our kids there and they were, had their banners and they were marching right up in the front with the kids from Standing Rock. And, you know, we taught them, you know, like it's so important to make your voice heard.
Yeah. You know, that analogy you make is like, I was teaching at the Chief Dollknife Tribal College here in Lame Deer when President Obama, he was a candidate then for president. He came to the neighboring reservation, the Crow Indian Reservation. So I have a lot of friends on Crow. So I called up my friends and they said, we're gearing up for Obama's going to be here. And I said, I want to bring some students from the tribal college. Can I bring them over? And they said, yes, you know, we'll put your name down because security is real tight. And how many you bring in? So just like that, you know, we had band loads of Cheyenne kids that were trekking over to Crow, which is like 40 miles away. It's not far. But we all got there. We made it through security. And I always remember like that story. It reminds me of what you're saying about Bobby Kennedy. President Obama was talking at the time, and he looked at all of the tribal college students, all Indian students, and he put his finger out at them and he said, I will never forget you. And the students, I felt, stood up in their identity and their belief. So I share that story with you because I can sense the need for our students to feel that they are not invisible.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, and that, you know, we're working on a theater piece right now with the youth, and it's called Invisible Shadows. And because it's we're doing this play around COVID and the George Floyd uprising that took place after the George Floyd murder. And this is what these young people have written about is, you know, they talk about like there was somebody was shot, an Indian person was shot at a Little Earth housing complex, right? The only housing for Native people in the country. And you know, and so they're playing a video game and they ask the other one, you know, like, hey, did you hear about that shooting at Little Earth? And the other one said, no. But 6 o'clock news is on. Let's turn it on. And so they turn it on and there's all this, you know, blah, 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 nothing about the shooting at Little Earth. And one of the kids says to the other one, you know, it's like we're invisible unless, you know, we go into a store, then they follow us. You know, we're invisible to them until they come after us. But what we try to teach them is you are valuable. You are, whatever tribe you are, you know, that is who you are. And at the end of this piece, one of the kids, wrote a piece about, being like an eagle, you know, Megan Z, and, you know, this Megan Z is flying up, 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 and the Megan Z says, why are the humans like that? We have different colors. We have different colored feathers, and yet we get along with each other. Why do the humans have to be so toxic to each other? Of course, we are predators. We have predators, but we are not toxic like the humans are to each other. When will they ever see a way to be different? When will they ever change? You know, question that you know, that children ask themselves, like, why do they dislike me? Because of the color of my skin, mm-hmm. because the color of my hair. Why do they? And, you know, and the answer cannot simply be because of greed. You know, it's something that is, you know, we have seven sacred teachings, and that is to be loving, to be kind, to be honest, to be courageous, and so on and so forth. And, you know, the teaching is, if you're not practicing kindness, then you're practicing the opposite. And so as babies, you know, we all come into the world with only gifts. Every baby is a gift, a sacred being. And so you can have three babies, you know, a black baby, a brown baby, a white baby, and they're out playing with each other, and they don't see that they're different, right? They're just playing with each other. But the first time one of those babies reaches over, takes the bottle away from another baby, clocks him over the head, you know, they're trading a little generosity for selfishness. And then as they grow, you know, I remember being 5 years old and in that foster home, and the minister's son, we were told to go outside and play. And they said, and the little boy said to me, you're a dirty Indian. And he was throwing rocks at me. I threw a rock back at him. Then I went in the house. I marched into the house. I stood on the toilet and I looked in the mirror and I thought, oh my God, I am an Indian. And that was like the first time I knew that I was Indian. So what possessed that little boy, you know, to do that? So that's trading kindness for hatred, right? And so if you trade most of your gifts away, then you become that opposite. You become like that. And so in our household, what we were taught was, you know, you take care of your family, your clan, your band, your tribe, and ultimately all of humanity. And if those kind of values aren't taught, then we end up with a society like we're living in today within the United States, where, you know, 106 members of the House of Representatives, you know, are voting for an authoritarian government as opposed to democracy, you know. And so.
Well, you know, that's fascinating too, that like kindness, and you're in a foster home. It sounds like a minister's foster home, right? You were living with the minister's son, or?
No, I was in a foster home. And, you know, back in those days, they used to have something called Ladies Aid Society. And so there were a lot of ladies inside having, I don't know what they did, but all of his kids were supposed to be outside playing. But it was the son of the minister who, you know, said that to me. I got in trouble for throwing a rock back. mm-hmm. You know, he was throwing rocks at me, and I'm like, threw a rock back at him. And of course, he went in and told on me, and I got in trouble. Yeah.
That's a good analogy, too, and good metaphor for life, isn't it? All right. So we want to move into, like, your work with the started out as an AIDS task force, right?
You know, so all of my life, I've either been working in public health, you know, as a worked within the school system, within as the chemical dependency counselor, and then an administrator, and I worked for the state for about 10 years, administering contracts and grants with the tribes. And then my younger brother, you know, called me up one day and said, you know, like, it's in 1987, you know, it's a big ACES. And then a Native woman who was a nurse came and told me the same thing, only she said, what are you going to do about it? And so we started the AIDS Task Force. And at that time, in 1987, 1988, you know, 1990, we lost so many brilliant people within the Native community. And I started the theater program in May of 1990 because I knew that youth would listen to other youth, and we needed to protect them so that they could survive this epidemic. And And you know, with AIDS, you had to do something to get it, right? You had to have unprotected sex, or you had to share a needle with somebody who was infected. Early on, it was transfusions, but then that all got cleared up. So basically, you had to do something to get it. So it was easy to teach prevention. Mm-hmm. But I knew we had to educate the young people. And so we started the theater program, because storytelling is such a part of our culture. It's how we have songs that are 500 years old. You know, it's how we have stories that are 500 years old and older that we still know today because of the storytelling. And so that's what we set out to do. And that has continued for the last 30 years. Today, we have youth in the program whose parents were in the program in the 90s. And so we teach them the craft of acting, which includes, you know, speaking, projecting, voice projection. You know, we do it just like people do, like basketball, right? You stand up in a line and you throw your voice over to that wall, and they all start off kind of like, you know, like go the back of the line, you know, and yet you come through until you know, can do it. And body, you know, we teach them how to use their body. We do meditation with them. We teach them about whatever it is that's happening. So as we look at this COVID epidemic today, you know, for us Native people, it's like historical trauma is triggered by COVID because of, you know, what happened to our ancestors and smallpox and all of those epidemics. And you know, and for people in my generation, you know, like our grandchildren, hopefully, you know, all, you know, they grew up in the always having protected sex, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what is that like? And today, you know, it's masks, you know, wear a mask, wash your hands, social distance. And so COVID is even worse because you don't have to do anything except not wear masks. That's what we're doing with them right now. And I forget the question.
That's a great story, though. It's a great, you know, segue right into like what you're doing with the water walks. Like, you know, how did that start, Sharon? And what does it mean to you?
Yeah, I think, you know, growing up in Minnesota, you know, and in northern Minnesota, harvesting wild rice out on the lakes, you know, like, that was part of our being, right? And knowing that wild rice was a sacred food to us. And, you know, as part of why we came here, following those prophecies to go to a place where food grows on the water. So the water has always been, and even, you know, like it's funny because even when I got into recovery, our life was so regimented every day. We had to do this and this and this, you know, me and my children were very young then, but every single night, after I got everything else done, I filled my bathtub with water, and then I would have a candle and I would just meditate in there. You know, when you're in the bathtub and it's the water's warm, I think it's like reminiscent of the womb, right? Mm-hmm. That's sort of gentle movement. And so I've always gone to the water for comfort. And well, then in 1998, there was a spring in Minneapolis, Camp Coldwater, where the Dakota people say that's one of their point of Genesis, where they came into the world. And the state was going to build a road. And so Bud Waywardin, he said, all you Madewin, go over there and help those Dakota people. And one of the things he said to all of us was, you know, what would happen if all of the women of the world stood up and said no more? No more to the cities and the corporations, the mining companies. We will not allow you to pollute our water anymore. And so that began my journey. And of course, you know, Josephine Mandam and the grandmother of the water walks, these contemporary walks, she, you know, I walked with her on that first walk in 2003. And in 2011, I led the walk from Gulfport, Mississippi to Lake Superior. And then 2 years later, led the walk on the Mississippi River. And, you know, I invite everybody to walk with me because most of us are disconnected from the land and the water today. And what we're trying to do with the water walks is to speak to those water spirits. And when we gather the water at the headwaters where it's still pure and clean most of the time, and we carry it to the mouth of the river, you know, we have a word in Ojibwe, zage is love. And that means to nurture. And zagitun is the mouth of the river. And that means where all things come to be nurtured. And that's the way the mouth of the river was. It was teeming with life. And now you go to the Gulf of Mexico, to the mouth of the Mississippi River, and it's a dead zone. And so when we gather that water at the headwaters, that was pure and clean, and we carried it all the way to the Gulf, you know, and we poured that water into the mouth of the river. And we said, this is how you began, pure and clean. And this is how we wish for you to be again. And then we poured that water into that dead zone. And I believe those water spirits, they hear us. Mm-hmm. They hear us every day as we're carrying that water, as we're praying, as we're singing. A reporter asked me once, he said, you know, you talk to the water, but does the water ever talk back to you? And I said, you know, as a matter of fact, it does. Mm-hmm. When we poured that water into the Gulf, a wave came. We were all standing in a line like this along the bank of the Mississippi. And a wave came and it touched our ankles. And then another wave came and it touched our shins. Not a person moved. We just stood there in that line. And then another wave. And the last wave, that fourth wave, came to our knees. And it was like being kissed by the river. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes I go down to Hidden Falls. Last winter, the winter before, we walked down there. What do you see out on the ice? A perfectly frozen heart. We sing, and then you hear, you know, we were singing one day, and ice was frozen. And then you could hear this. And I opened my eyes and looked, and right in front of us, this big block of ice was just breaking up. So, yes. The river, the water, it does speak to us. Just last Sunday, we were right over here by my house, about a mile away. And, just me and one other person, Nicole, and we did the water ceremony and right, we could see she had walked out to shore a little bit and there was this muskrat swimming underneath and we caught it on camera, you know. But yeah, the water does speak back to us. And so you know, the first walk I did was kind of reluctant. The Mississippi, you know, I planned that walk, but then I said, that's enough, you know. And people were saying, well, let's do another walk. And I'm like, you know, I'm the only one that walked every single day from the Gulf of Mississippi, Gulfport, Mississippi, to Lake Superior, 42 days. I'm the only one who did that. Nobody else walked all those days. And on the Mississippi River, I walked 63 days from the headwaters to 90 miles past New Orleans. Nobody did that but me. Who else has walked from the south to the north and the north to the south? No, I'm done. And then one of the women came and she gave me, she said, what about the Ohio? It's the biggest polluter of the Mississippi. And I said, well, yes. And, you know, there are many other people to do this work too. And then she brought me an eagle head for my staff. And I looked at her and first I cussed at her and then I cried and I said, okay, the Ohio River, we'll walk the Ohio River. And then after that, I just gave up, gave in, surrendered. Mm-hmm. This is what I will do, and I will walk for as long as I can walk.
Wow.
And bring as many people along with me as I can.
Wonderful. Wow. What a legacy. So, Sharon, I think about your life story starting out, you know, one of many in a large family. on the reservation, being put into foster care, you know, when you're very young, 4 or 5 years old, then being taken to with your brother, you know, raising your own money, picking berries to get back by bus to your mother and to St. Paul. The challenges of your life, your dad getting killed, you know, the alcoholism, the pain, the trauma. And through it all, you know, being strong with what your dad said, stand up for what you believe in. And I think that in closing, the recognition that you've received in Minnesota, the governor of Minnesota, the mayors, St. Paul, Minneapolis, you know, naming a special day after you in honor and recognition of your life's work of taking care of humanity. You know, the proclaiming Sharon M. Day in November 10th, 1998. How did that make you feel?
You know, that day that that happened, they were doing the this award over at, I think it was a Holiday Inn at by the University of Minnesota. And this was before cell phones, right? 1998. And I went over there and getting ready for that ceremony. And a waiter came and said, "Sharon, you have a Miss Day, there's a telephone call for you. You can take it on that wall phone." So I walked over there and I picked it up. And, you know, it was a woman who had been a client of mine when I was a counselor at a halfway house. And she said, "Sharon," and she told me who she was. And she said, "I don't know if you remember me." And I said, "No, of course I remember you." And she said, "I saw in the newspaper this morning that you were getting this award. And if I'd have known about it, I would have been there." She said, "I want you to know that today I'm a probation officer. I've been sober for 10 years. I'm a probation officer. And thank you so much." And, you know, that phone call meant more to me than those proclamations. To touch somebody's life. You know, I think of all the kids I've worked with. And, you know, I love them. And no matter what happens, tomorrow's a new day. You know, one of my older adopted brothers, used to say, like, somebody falls down, reach out, give them a hand up. I've had that hand extended to me many times. Reach your hand out, help somebody. And I think, you know, those are good words, good rule to live by.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Sharon. What a wonderful interview. We love you.
Thank you. I love you too.